Welcome to All Right, Now What? Season 8, Shifting the Story. I'm Mitzi Hunter at the Canadian Women's Foundation. Today's episode is a really special one. I'm joined by Madame Diana Fox Carney, an economist and climate expert whose work has taken her from Africa to the UK to here in Canada, and whose career has focused on tackling some of the biggest challenges of our time. Diana has spent years working at the intersection of climate action, economic decision-making, and social impact, and brings a perspective that's both global and deeply human. Her work pushes us to think differently about leadership and about how we build systems that truly work for people. Today, we'll talk about leadership in uncertain times, the connections between climate and economic justice, and what it means to create spaces in our workplaces, our communities, and our institutions where women and gender diverse people fully thrive. Diana, I'm so honored that you're here with us today. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mitzi. The pleasure is all mine, and I'm excited for our conversation.
I'm excited for our conversation. It's an opportunity to really talk about the things that are impactful and that really matter to you.
Excellent. Always like to talk about myself.
Okay. So let's just dive right in. Can you share your journey and some of the pathways that you've taken to bring you to this moment?
It's a long and winding road at this advanced age. But I started my career in business when I came out of grad school initially. And I think it was about day two or day three that I realized that that was probably not the life for me. And so I went off and did an internship at the European Commission. I was in the UK at the time. The UK was also in the European Union at the time. And I ended up in the Development Directorate of the European Commission. It was then that I really saw potential to go overseas, to work, to do things that I felt were more impactful, and to flip my career on its head, leave behind the for-profit world, and focus on impact. And after that, as you say, I went off to Africa, working with the UK government at the time, and I was living in Zanzibar, which was an interesting place to live, mm-hmm. and spent several years out there and then working in development in the UK, in a think tank in the UK. During that period of my life, I met my husband. It was when I was doing my second master's at Oxford that I met Mark. So when I was in Africa, he was finishing his PhD in Oxford, and we got married shortly after I got back from Africa. Anyway, all that to say that I was working in development initially in agriculture very specifically, and I really saw the impact of climate on people in these very precarious circumstances in drought-prone areas in northern Kenya, other places like that. The impact of even really fractional change in climate was absolutely catastrophic. And it was at that point that I began to think, maybe that's the area that I should devote my attention to. And maybe what we're doing here on traditional development spending is a bit like closing the stable door after the horse has bolted. And if we're just exporting a warming climate to countries that can barely cope, even in the absence of that warming climate, and then coming with a sticking plaster to try and make amends, that was a slightly bizarre approach. So that's when I really turned around and began to focus more holistically on development issues, on climate, and on environmental things, of environmental sustainability in nature more generally. But as you say, and we can get into it later on, my career has been anything but a straight line, and I have deviated and gone backwards and forwards and worked on other issues. When I was working at a think tank here in Canada, I worked much more on social issues, income inequality, health spending, these kinds of things. So I'm a generalist at heart, with a deep concern for everything, nature and environment.
I'm very curious in terms of what you talk about, like even small fractional changes can have outsized effects and can determine trajectory. So as a generalist, how do you choose the path?
This generalist specialist issue has plagued me all my life. I think it's extremely hard to, for someone like me, for someone with my characteristics, it's extremely hard to choose one path because then you're closing so many doors around you. So I think what I've tried to do is focus on where I've thought I can make the biggest contribution. And in some ways that's a learning exercise about your own capabilities, but it's also how the world is moving and how which particular sector, which types of organizations are having the most impact at any given time.
Oh, that's so great. So you've spent much of your life navigating leadership in high-pressure environments. Tell us how you cope with such environments and just stay grounded and keep on your purpose.
I'm glad you consider me grounded. No, I do. For me, a lot of it comes down to what you're like, how you brought up, how you are raised to think about yourself in certain environments. And I grew up in a very, very practical family. I grew up in a family of women. My father was not around for most of my childhood, and I had two sisters. And we were a very practical family where the obligation and expectation was that you would do everything for yourself, that idleness was the enemy, and that excelling was not an option, but a necessity, I guess. And you can argue that that's not a healthy way to grow up, but that's the way I grew up. So I think that kind of background has given me a sense that everyone works for what they get, and that the way to operate in any environment is by being on top of your material, by always being able to deliver when people need you to deliver, by being extremely reliable. And I think those things stand you in good stead, whatever level that you're operating. And while I do, it's clear that I am in environments now that are extremely high level. That certainly has not always been the case. But I think my behavior has changed little depending on what environment I'm in. And it seems to have worked.
It's amazing how those early days really shape your work ethic, how you see the world. So no matter what the environment is that you're in or what spaces you're in, you are who you are.
You are who you are. That's true. And I think, the key thing that I've learned over time is to maintain curiosity. Everyone is interesting at some level about something. And if you always have your eyes open and your ears open, your life is so much richer for that. And trying to ensure that everyone feels heard. Not everyone's voices can always sort of reach the outcome, but to ensure that everyone feels heard, and that ideally you can make your way to consensus. I know it's pretty hard at times, but you're right. It's a lot comes from the way you were raised, values that you had as a child. I think, experiences and being open to course corrections. I don't think leadership necessarily comes naturally to everyone. We all have to be prepared to learn and to adjust our behaviors.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I want to talk a little bit about climate, the economy, and women's leadership, because I think our listeners will really relate to your path. And in your experience, what are the most significant gendered impacts of climate change in Canada? And how do we show up in women's everyday lives? Like how does the impact of climate affect our lives?
Climate affects us all, unfortunately. it's well recognized that it affects women more for two principal reasons. And this applies in Canada and in other countries. But firstly, the greatest vulnerabilities are experienced by those with the least economic well-being, or the least, the fewest economic means. So the poorer you are, the harder it is in general to adapt to climate change, to find alternatives, to rebuild if your house is washed away, all these other things. Money helps us. You know, that is why it is easier for Western countries, obviously, to manage and cope with climate change. Not easy, but easier than it is for some of the more marginal countries that have, you know, lower GDP per capita and less ability to spend their way out of problems. Yeah. So women, as we know, are paid less well than men for the same job. Mm-hmm. They are typically less well off. So this means that they have disproportional impact from climate change. So that's reason number one. Reason number two is that, of course, climate change impacts are centered often around things to do with the household, with family, with caring. Climate impacts disease burden. It impacts food availability, food prices. It impacts certainly in places that I've worked. You know, it's the women typically who will be collecting water, collecting firewood, all these other things. Mm-hmm. These become more challenging when climate impacts hit hard. Yeah. So I think it's that the kind of household and caring responsibilities tend to be those that are most greatly impacted. Mm-hmm. So again, women bear not exclusive burden, and I'm sure there's many households where it's mm-hmm. reversed, but that tends to be the case. And so often when there are, you know, very strong stresses at a household level, it's women who will suffer. And I think, you know, we see that in Canada. And we see it in some of the communities that are some of the remote communities where we're seeing a very strong impact of climate change already. And it is often women who absorb that stress that is impacting the whole family, but somehow it's the women's responsibility to address it, to deal with it, to manage the children, to cope with what's taking place. So
talk to us about solutions. So how do we shift this problem and create some lasting solutions?
I think the one major change that has taken place during my career in the climate space, which is now spanning, I'm going to say 30 years, is a real sense or belief or understanding that solutions are possible. 30 years ago, everything seemed extremely difficult. It still seems difficult, but it seemed even harder. We didn't have many of the technical solutions that we have now. And the cost of those solutions that had been produced was extremely high. And it was about 10 years or so ago that I think people began to see that there could be, if we do the right thing, there could be a future that was not deeply austere, that was a future of plenty, that drew on some of these incredible advances in energy generation, renewable energy, all these other things, which, you know, just hadn't existed when I started. I mean, I had a solar panel in Africa, and I would not want it to, you know, could barely charge, boil my kettle with it. Whereas now we can, you know, power whole communities with solar, for example. So I think there are solutions. I'm not saying that, you know, technology, that there's a technological fix, because a lot of what we have to do is get to a place where we're able to deploy those solutions. Mm-hmm. And that is a challenge given human nature and the prioritization of the here and now mm-hmm. over the future, our discount rates in technical language. I wrote my master's thesis on discount rates, so it's always been close to my heart.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to make those decisions, and it's difficult to do that in a globally competitive environment. And there's many reasons why we are not where perhaps we could be. on our climate and environmental journey. I would like to broaden it out because it's not just climate. It is our nature, the drastic collapse in species and ecosystem collapse. And water is a massive issue in the world today, a massive and growing issue. Well, growing and massive, I think. Yes, it's extremely hard, but there are solutions, there are ways forward. If we can find that narrow pathway through, and you know, I recognize that people have absolute priorities in the here and now, and they need to feed their families, they need to have a job, they need to, you know, have a security and all these things that we seek in our lives, and that it's very easy to put climate aside and say, it's not my problem. It's, you know, I can get through. But it is the problem of our children. And so we do have to find ways to, as I say, find that narrow and difficult pathway through to a better future.
Let's hone in on that narrow pathway. And if you can fix your sights on that, when you could shift the story, what would be that?
Well, I think in some ways, I think I've already said a little bit of what I think the story should be. I mean, I think one thing I've realized in my life is that it is all about stories, right? It's about the narrative. And I think increasingly in today's world, we recognize that sort of stark data and facts are not what lead us through things. It's a story in which people can believe and to which people can adhere. I think in the case of climate, if I could change one belief or one part of the story, it would be the idea that it's too expensive for us to make the changes that we need to. It's undoubtedly difficult, and it's difficult to transition from an economy based entirely on fossil fuels to one that is entirely renewable. And it's going to be we're already seeing a bumpy journey, a difficult journey. But we also see a journey that just makes a lot of sense because, for example, renewable power is both less vulnerable to geopolitical tensions. It tends to be domestic. You own it. You can deploy it. It helps with the issues that we're concerned about. In other ways, it's cheaper. It's, you know, healthier from a non-climate health perspective, but fewer sort of less particulate matter, all these other things. There's so many things going for it. That doesn't mean to say it's going to be easy. The fact that something is cheaper, better, cleaner is fantastic, but it's not, doesn't make it inevitable. So we still have to work hard. But I would just want to shift that narrative so that it wasn't seen as a luxury that we can't afford, but a necessity that we must figure out a clever way to integrate into our life going forward.
More recently, you attended the opening of the newly renovated Kehoe Forum in Cape Breton. And the first rink in Canada dedicated to women, girls, and para hockey. So what did that moment mean to you? And how does it reflect on your own experience growing up?
So I was very proud and fortunate to be part of that opening. Incredible facility, much nicer than anything I've ever played in, I think. And as you say, it was great that it's para hockey, it's sledge hockey too. I think, you know, what I would like to see, and I think what everyone would like to see, is real equality of opportunity. I think as in many things, you often have to be very deliberate to achieve that. So why do we need an arena dedicated to women? It's because the women couldn't get any ice time there. And what's been incredibly heartening in my understanding is that the numbers of women, you know, women my age, older women, but also young girls who are playing hockey now in Sydney, there's been an exponential growth in that. They have great ice time. They have a, you know, comfortable, warm, safe, lovely arena. I'm sure the parents of the young girls are happy too. They have somewhere nice to sit and have a cup of coffee. But but they were not previously able to get ice time. They were pushed out because there was lots of grandfathered teams having all the decent ice time, and, you know, young girls can't play at, you know, 10, 11 o'clock at night, et cetera. So this was a real necessity. And I think that that's the way, you know, we have to push to get some of these things. It's not to say that, you know, the women don't want to share the ice time with men. They just want to be treated and have, you know, equal rights. And the way to do that sometimes is to overcompensate, right? To say, okay, let's have this arena for them and for women. So I was very proud to be part of that opening. I'm very positive about anything that expands access to hockey playing. I loved playing hockey. I took up hockey only at university, but it was a really important part of my life. I love the idea that, you know, women are now playing much, or there's much more possibility of more serious hockey playing. There's the PWHL, there's a trajectory, there's a way forward, people, there's teams to watch. My, you know, I go see the team in Ottawa, and my kids are big supporters too. So anything that expands that, and I know it's a challenging sport, it's an expensive sport, other things, but I'm a big hockey supporter.
I think that's really great. And I think it shifts, you know, what we think about for girls growing up in terms of, you know, girls can play hockey and any other sport that they want.
They can play rugby. Rugby, when I grew up, certainly was a boys' sport. And we were fortunate enough to see the Women's World Cup in rugby, the final, Canada versus England, which was fantastic. So, as you say, pretty much every sport, you know, is opening up or has opened up to women, which is fantastic.
Yes. Basketball. That was the sport in my household.
Right.
So I want to talk about leadership, resilience, and really looking forward. Women leaders frequently face a different set of expectations. And you already hinted at, you may not see it, you know, when you're beginning your career, but as you advance, you recognize that the challenge is different. So how have you learned to navigate that for yourself while staying true to yourself?
I think it's something that all women would recognize. I wish all men would recognize it, but that it is harder. You're more criticized as a woman leader than as a male leader. You know, sometimes I like to think it's like, you know, we expect men to be bad at leadership, so we don't bother criticizing them. We expect women to be great, so we're more critical. Yeah. But that's a good spin on it, maybe. But it's undoubtedly the case. And I think I remember going to one of my kids' schools, and there was a talk, a sort of parenting talk, and it was about this idea that we expect from a very young age, girls to be everything. They're supposed to be smart, good at sport, clever, pretty, well turned out, polite, always very polite and help out and do everything. Whereas we allow our men to be our boys. That this conversation was, I didn't have any boys, so I couldn't see this, but, you know, he's great at sport, but he doesn't do X, Y, and Z, or, you know, he's not very polite, but, you know, he's fantastically clever. Whereas girls, we expect everything from them from a very early age. And this idea stuck with me. And I think it's probably something we have to start changing, you know.
Along those lines, leading up to International Women's Day, we want to take some time to recognize and to celebrate those women who have perhaps impacted our lives or helped to influence. So who has impacted your life that you want to give a shout out to?
I would say the people in my life who have inspired me most. I would start with my grandmother, who lived till she was 100. She died shortly after my fourth child was born. So she knew or saw that I had four children before she died. But she was a very strong influence in my life, my siblings' life. And she was that generation of people, you know, born at the turn of the century, lived through extraordinary change, lived through the war, you know, took in prisoners of war on a farm in England, etc. But she had those sort of strong, sometimes slightly irritating, lectury tendencies, but, you know, very strong values, belief in generosity, kindness, fairness, all the things, all the values that I think I hope to adhere to going forward. Not material, you know, all about kind of spiritual value. So she was a strong influence on me growing up. And I'd say beyond that, I'm very fortunate to have very good set of girlfriends here in Ottawa. I have a similar set who are like literally my high school friends in the UK who are still my greatest friends. But I'm going to call out some of my friends in Ottawa in as much as, you know, I have a, you know, unusual life now. They're extremely supportive of me. If I didn't have them around me now, I think I would struggle. And they're an amazing set of, you know, diverse women, lots of, you know, doctors and lawyers and, you know, civil servants, a variety of people who've come together for different reasons and are also inspiring in their own way.
Your husband happens to be the Prime Minister of Canada. And you talked about meeting him at Oxford. So talk to me about how you balance that support while protecting your own voice, which, by the way, I believe needs to be heard based on our conversation today. And, I just also want to say that, you know, women are looking at how to navigate this world and manage all of the different roles that we play. So how do you keep and protect your own voice that you have earned through education, work, and life?
So I have my professional interests. I work, I have professional relationships with people that significantly predated my husband having this role. So, you know, the jobs that I do are the same jobs that I did 2 years ago, and I'm the same person. And after an initial slight flurry of questioning amongst those that I work with whether anything have changed, I think they realized that, you know, nothing's changed. I'm just me, and I'm carrying on doing what I was doing. So that helps. It helps keep me kind of grounded. I'm just myself. In that space. So that is good. And I don't feel that I'm always kind of an appendage of my husband. That said, I quite often am too. I mean, I accompany him. I find it a great privilege to accompany him from the campaign onwards. And I'm extremely proud of him and proud to be by his side. But I'm also very grateful for the number of Canadians, mostly women, but not exclusively women, who will come up to me and express appreciation for the role that I'm playing or for, partly just supporting him and making sure he gets to the office on time every day or something. But, just recognizing that it's a relatively challenging position because there is no job and there is no role, and it's sort of what you do and what you make of it. So I've been extremely, it's been wonderful to meet many Canadians, and I've been extremely grateful for the kind of support that I feel like they have given me to say, okay, you're doing an okay job here. But I think, you know, it's hard. It's an exceptionally difficult time. And undoubtedly, there is a huge amount of stress. And, you know, my role, as I say, you know, we've been married for more than 30 years. So we're kind of used to it. But, it's just support him. And, you know, it is, he needs to have some downtime at home, and I need to have some downtime with him. I think it's important that you have some time off with your partner. And we're still able to enjoy doing that together.
So, Diana, We've talked about many things today. And given your experience and your background, if there's one thing that you know will make a difference in the state of women in the world today, what would that be? What would you change?
So I would love to have a proverbial magic wand and change many things. But I think the one thing that has struck me recently is that I can't be certain that we are still making progress globally on women's issues. In fact, I'm fairly certain that we might be losing some of the ground that we, the hard-fought ground that we achieved. So if I could change anything, it would be, I don't know how I do it. This is where the magic wand comes in, but I would get to a place where I was still absolutely certain that we were heading forward and that women were little by little achieving greater equality, equality of respect, of pay, of opportunity, all these other things. And even if the pace may have decelerated, that we were still on the right pathway. That would make me exceptionally happy. And I'm trusting that you and the foundation can find ways here in Canada, where I think actually the good thing about Canada is I feel that we are still in a good place. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about globally, the sense of progress is diminishing, if not halted. So I'd love to see that change.
Thank you to our listeners for joining us for this special International Women's Day episode of All Right, Now What? We'll see you next time.
The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and its partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Inuit, and Métis territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.